if I may say, I realize it's a late, but happy Valentine's Day to you, Justin.
And you as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. And to you, listener, happy belated Valentine's
Sure. Day. Yep. Yeah. But speaking of the 14th of February, what comes 2 weeks later?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy, we're doing this again.
Wait, I'm just saying what comes 2 weeks after the 14th.
Yes, I think that math checks out. The 28th at 7 p.m.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, that's when we're going to hang out with you folks.
That's our hope.
That's our hope. That
we're going to be here, so we're yes. hoping you come hang out with us.
Grant us this belated Valentine's gift.
Oh, there you go.
Your presence.
There you go. No, but that's coming right up.
It is.
Yeah.
I'm going to say this.
Okay.
It should be a week from the time you're listening to this.
Yes.
If you listen next Wednesday. Anyway, 28th.
That's from the voice of our director, editor, you know, yeah. designer.
That's
yeah,
right.
Speaking directly to you. So
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, all those things.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So the one we released yesterday, you know, obviously we talked about this too.
We tried.
Yeah. It was so bad. And the thing is, I cut out probably 2/3 of it.
Really?
And it was still...
It was still as muddy as it was.
Pretty hilariously stumbled.
I gotcha.
But I cut out.
Oh, man.
2/3 of it. So we did pretty good this time.
Okay. Yeah.
The math isn't important. The 28th. That's what matters.
The 28th. That's exactly it. 7 p.m. Yes, indeed.
Thank you for reminding them and us and me. I'll be there.
Yes, indeed. It's part of my job. I figure you have many hats. At least I can do is be mindful of the things that are coming up.
You're doing great.
Well, we'll do what we can.
Thank you.
Welcome to How I See It with me, Mark Pratt, and
Justin Sternberg. This is a podcast that works to counter cultural polarization through thoughtful conversations.
So yeah, you got a topic
Speaking
for today?
Speaking of things coming up, what's our topic?
What's our topic? I got a topic for us this day.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it. Have you ever had a muscle that was problematic?
Oh yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like how? Like a back, a leg?
Most recently, my shoulder. When it was really bad.
Sure. And what happened?
I think it was a muscle.
Yeah?
It could have been the tendon or the tendon, right? Probably, maybe. I don't know. Did the details matter whether it was a tendon or a muscle?
Okay. No. But I mean, realistically, it's the same thing. The muscle is the group, and the tendon is what connects it to the bone, if you will.
Okay.
So in that process, there's a tearing of that muscle system, and it hurts.
Yeah.
And quite often, in order to repair that muscle, you just have to kind of give it some special attention. Maybe lighten up on it a little bit. Maybe even stretch it more. You follow me in that process?
Yeah.
And although I recognize there's a difference between our muscular system and our nervous system, there's a part of me, and like I say, I get passionate about the way we're designed by God from my perspective, but I believe our brain falls into that category. It's not necessarily muscular, but I think it's like a muscle. So how we exercise it, what we think about, how we stretch it, how we use it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I thought
it was a muscle.
I don't see it as a muscle as far as movement goes.
Yeah.
It controls our movement.
Maybe it's not a muscle. I don't know.
And that's what I believe it's part of our nervous system.
Yeah.
You know, where our nerves are connected. So, of course, our brain connects the muscles. But I think about it in a similar fashion as I think about muscles, because I think we can deliberately strengthen our brain and we can by default allow our brain to atrophy. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
And I was, as I was thinking about, or, you know, kind of thinking about meditation, I think that's what, if I were to kind of simplify the whole meditation thing, it is a process of managing what my brain does or how I use my brain, what I think about. And it kind of brings back, you know, as I'm thinking about meditation, and granted, I'm going to recognize that much of what we know about, you know, meditation in general, I put my little bunny ear caps quotation marks out there in general, you know, is going to come from the Tibetan monks and that kind of stuff. And, you know, the research that they've done, you know, on the brain and that kind of thing. And I respect that, because I'm willing to recognize those individuals have taken meditation to another level. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're like the Olympic.
The marathon. I was just going to say, yeah, they're the Olympic athletes, the marathon runners, you know, the ultra distance runners of the meditation thing. You follow me? And yet that's not to say that the average individual can't exercise meditation. And I'm going to probably use the words a little more interchangeably between meditation and mindfulness, you know, because we've done mindfulness.
Yeah.
But both, from my perspective, are kind of a controlled focus.
So that right off the bat, though, we should make the distinction between the kind of meditation you're referring to versus, I think, Eastern meditation, right?
Sure.
Which is the idea of emptying the mind, right?
Yep. And I'm going to look at it from a biblical standpoint, my perspective, more like the Proverbs, as a man thinks, so he becomes. And it's not so much that I'm emptying this myself, my brain, to just allow. And granted, granted, some of that may be a hijacked Western culture view. You know what I'm saying? I'm not emptying just to allow anything to come in. I think we can be a little bit judgmental in that. If I'm emptying, I want to recognize, though, my desire is to focus on what Christ has wants to fill me with, you know, versus just emptying to have nothing, or, you know, but I'm still going to recognize that that takes a tremendous amount of energy to be able to stay in that singular focus mind. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And yes, I am recognizing from a biblical sense, the way we think matters so much. And it's interesting because the funny part of it is, from my perspective, mindfulness, you know, meditation isn't just a mental health issue anymore, because there's been a lot of research that has basically connected it to our body, our physical condition. It's been, you know, connected with, you know, anxiety reduction, you know, blood pressure reduction, you know, a lot of these things we're able to recognize how connected our body is, our brain and our body. And therefore, when we kind of, we're just designed that way from my perspective.
Yeah.
So what we think about things matters. If I start, you know, just kind of throwing some, like I could probably throw some cultural, you know, negative war and, you know, economy.
Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift.
Yeah, I can start throwing these things out here.
Chiefs won the Super Bowl.
Yeah. And as we, and this, that's a great example of what our brain does.
Zeitgeist.
Yes. Each and every moment is, we can have these rabbit trails, if you will, that end up taking me, these other places and I lose focus of where I'm to be. Mm-hmm. That's how I'm seeing this, the meditation process. And I think even in mindfulness, I'll come back to it. We talked about the two circles. We talked about the aspect of the, we talked about where I have this cognitive mind and I have this emotion mind as two circles.
Yeah.
And where they overlap like a Venn diagram, that's the wise mind where I'm able to think and feel. Mm-hmm. In that process,
yeah, that's right.
Because I think so often our tendency is to be comfortable in one or the other. We're either comfortable in our emotion and we just like to go there and we're very feeling oriented, or we tend to cut that part off and we're more cognitive oriented,
analytical,
and emotions don't matter. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think in the wise mind, it does matter. I think that's where Jesus lived his life, knowing full well what he was to do, despite how he might have felt at certain times. Not that he minimized those emotions. He didn't push them away. Yeah. That's what made him empathetic in my perspective.
Yeah.
But as I think about the whole meditation process, it's interesting that research is telling us, you know, how when a person is able to engage in that process, it keeps the brain, and this is where it kind of gets exciting for me, it keeps the brain from going into a default mechanism. Okay, well, our brains, and this is kind of neat for me because I help people process this default mechanism all the time.
Yeah. Is that kind of like the primal stuff that we're talking about, the primal question?
It's a combination of I would give it the primal, but it's the primal question. Because, well, when our brain, I don't want to necessarily use a lot of terminology, you know, brain terminology. I'm not a geeked out person.
I want to sound like a geek when I tell people these words, so give them to me.
Well, if that was the case, don't take offense to this, but if we wanted the real terminology, I should have invited Lizzie because she's got all the neural pathways and what controls that. Mm. But I basically, it's the cingulate cortex.
Yes.
Yeah. It's part of the limbic
cingulate
system.
Cingulate cortex.
Yes, that's...
Which is part of the limbic system.
Limbic
system.
Where emotions are processed, mm-hmm. Okay? That's where our brain will tend to go in its default state, mm-hmm. Okay? And that part of that system is where we also process pain. Now, and I when I say pain, I'm going to link it more to emotional pain, okay, than I am physical pain. I have to delineate the two because I can't guarantee that the physical pain is definitely there, but definitely it's connected with emotional pain. So for me, in that process, when that becomes my default mechanism, that I start heading towards my emotion, where emotions are processed, it makes sense that I kind of go down this rabbit hole, or I can go down this rabbit hole into the things that have hurt me, what may happen, you know, that when we're thinking about this from anxiety, when we're thinking about this from, you know, hurts, habits, and hangups, okay, we're going to be able to recognize that's where our brain goes by default.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, it makes perfect sense that that's not necessarily a healthy place for us to spend time. So meditation is that ability. And here again, I want to avoid any aspect of judgment. Okay, because so often that's part of the problem, is I'm judging myself based on what others have said about me or judging myself. So I try to do meditation. Okay. And granted, there's the research is there that says, hey, you don't even have to do this more than 5 to 10 days, 2 weeks, and you will start noticing differences in how your body performs, much like we talk about the muscles. You know, if I start exercising, if I start choosing to meditate on what God says, not what somebody said about me in the past, it's going to make a tremendous difference. Kind of like the songs we sing when we do worship. It's like, it's not who they say I am, but it's who God says I am. And if I choose to focus, if I choose to meditate on who God says I am and what God says he'll do, it's going to make a tremendous difference. You follow me?
Yeah.
All the hocus pocus of, you know, Eastern versus Western meditation aside, what I think about matters, and how I choose to focus is probably the most important part of directing my thoughts. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because and this is where I tend to see it, and you can see this with people. Okay, it's not just me, but you can kind of tell, like, especially when we're in here, you know, we're pretty much eye to eye talking back and forth. And I know when you're tired, you know when I'm tired, you can tell when we're engaged, you can tell when we're not, based on that focus.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it outside of this room, of course, with other people. You can tell, you know, when you're talking with them and their eyes are shifting to other places, seeing who's walking by, seeing who else they want to greet. Oh, I may want to catch that person, da, 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 da. Versus being able to stay focused on the individual in front of them in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's another example of what meditation looks like. It's that ability to maintain a focus. And in that process, okay, I want to recognize, now, if I lose that focus for a moment, I'm not going to get all frustrated at myself and say, oh, I'm not good at this, I can't do this, there's no use. You follow me? I'm going to recognize, oh, I slipped. I let it go for a moment, but yet I can go right back to the thought that I had. And that's what the practice is about from my perspective. It's not that anybody can learn to meditate. It's the process of choosing to do so and then being able to recognize that it's beneficial.
Yeah.
And not getting frustrated in the process. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah. Question. I'm sorry. I didn't want to. I'll let you share your thoughts for a moment.
You're good. Just a lot of this makes me think about the transformation that can occur when someone gets really involved, for instance, at Celebrate Recovery.
Sure.
And the reason is, you know, they're involved in Friday nights, they're involved in worship, they're involved in the teaching or the testimony, and they're involved in a step study and potentially involved in some accountability groups or with a sponsor relationship. And then ideally involved in a weekly church service.
Sure.
And that is basically intensive focus, right?
Sure.
On working past some hurts, habits, and hangups and moving forward into a healthy version of yourself.
Sure.
And that's not like traditional meditation by any means, you know.
No, kind of, I hear you.
But I think what's so cool about that is it's kind of what you're saying is it's yes. Learning how to focus on the right things and shift to what's right. And keep your mind on those things. And what's cool about that kind of intensive situation is it's kind of built in. You don't have to work as hard. It's kind of just you show up and it's working. And
it becomes part of the step process.
Yeah. I think the struggle can be you finish a step group. You know, Friday nights aren't convenient anymore, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's when people will tend to relapse. And it's not because Celebrate Recovery is some sort of miracle place or whatever. It's because you're no longer that focused.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
And so it's easier and easier and easier as time passes to slip into the limbata system.
Limbic. Cingulate cortex.
The default.
Yes, the default.
Yeah. And I think, so what's crucial about this conversation is to say this practice of meditation is crucial to everyone, you know, even if you're in a good place, because you need to learn those tools to be able to use when you don't have the perfect,
sure,
guardrails all around you.
Yep.
Right. And to be able to kind of go, okay, I see him slipping into the default. How can I?
Yeah.
Is that fair?
That's very fair. And I think what I've, and then of course we're going to have to, you know, we don't have time to necessarily, unpack all of the other part, but I want to recognize when we go back, when we go to that default mechanism, okay, there is that part of us when we've experienced a certain level of pain, okay, and meditation is also helpful in maintaining focus because we can recognize that there is a purpose in pain. But I believe from a cultural standpoint, we've gotten to the point where pain is to be minimized at all cost, emotional or physical. You follow me? We don't necessarily see a purpose in it. We don't value it. It's something to be dealt with, to be minimized. And I think, unfortunately, when we think about, and we'll talk about probably marijuana at another time, but alcohol is the same thing. When I'm tending to medicate, that pain with these, substances, if I may, as we're thinking about CR, but really thinking about, how our culture has shifted more and more to legalizing marijuana, and granted, we can talk the how I see it of that another time, but I also recognize how that is counter to my meditative process, because I believe there is something, it's interesting, granted, Scripture tells us not to be intoxicated. Okay. It doesn't necessarily tell us not to drink. You follow me? There's a line there. And I think part of that is it's like when I'm intoxicated, I've just completely lost my ability to meditate, to focus, to, to exercise my brain in any way at all. And I think that's the part that God basically is saying, hey, don't go there. There's no benefit to it. Bring your pain to me. Recognize there is a pain. Recognize it has purpose. And then we can deal with it. And I kind of get a chuckle, I think it's towards the end of Proverbs, maybe around 30. It might be around 31 prior to, the Proverbs 31 woman. But it's like the mother is talking to her son, the king, and basically saying, hey, you're a king. Don't drink. Don't get drunk, But, if there's a guy that's having an issue, go ahead and give him something to minimize his pain. But as a king, you stay focused. Don't let alcohol be that thing that trips you up. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. It's like, this is a mother's advice, it's like, stay away from alcohol. It doesn't do you any good, but if you want to give a guy a little bit of pity, you can give him a drink if he's in a tough time. Well, I can understand that as a mother's wisdom. My perspective is it's like, let's be mindful of that habit we create for that other person as well. But, being able to say, okay, yeah, there is something about that alcohol that I can tend to learn to be dependent upon to avoid the pain of the emotion. And that's what that's what connects the meditation process for me so well, or, any other substance that I am medicating pain with, that's that. And
yeah, it becomes, do you want to go?
No, you're fine.
Remember what you say.
Yeah.
It becomes like Pavlov's bell. You're familiar with that.
It becomes habitual.
Yeah. You're like the Pavlov, whenever he would ring a bell. He would feed the dogs or whatever. He would give them a treat. And eventually, he stopped giving them a treat. And the bell always signaled, come to me. Right.
Right.
So, or whatever that was. And I think that's what happens when you start treating your symptoms with a substance or a bad habit.
Sure.
Right? Of any kind. Yep. It can be a substance. It can, the substance is a combo thing. It's a bad habit, and it actually is solving the problem for you, right? Like, it's dulling your senses. It's giving you the ability to stop thinking about the problem in a lot of cases, although it has diminishing returns, yada, yada.
It's not necessarily solving it, but
I'm saying from your immediate
yes.
Pavlov's response. You're like, ding, okay, I'm better. Yep. You know, and so the next time pain comes, well, now the bell rang and you know exactly what to do.
Sure.
Right? Is go back to that thing, that substance, that habit or whatever. And obviously that's hugely problematic. And that's, that's what, you know, obviously we're talking about addiction at this point. That's what addiction looks like is the circumstances triggering that habit. You know, that it's that same Pavlov's kind of situation happening in your brain. And, you know, meditation obviously is the attempt at the opposite, I think, which is taking control of your brain or taking control of the focus, to say. But yeah,
I'm the mind.
I'm with you in the sense that obviously there's a balance. There's some amount of pain that our body can't process and therefore it goes into shock, right?
Sure.
And therefore there is levels of pain. Everyone has different levels, right? Where once it's beyond that threshold, you can't process it. It's, it's beyond your normal ability to process it. Now, I'm not ruling out, you know, God-given, supernatural, Holy Spirit type stuff, but
your body would go into shock when it experiences physical pain. I believe it's part of dissociation when we go into the mental pain, the emotional anguish of, you know, being raped or, you know, those kind of things. I'm going to, you know.
That's like the emotional shock, basically, that that turns your brain off a little bit to say you can't experience this in its fullest.
Exactly.
In a safety mechanism. Yeah.
Sure. And yet I would also recognize that that's primarily in that moment. And I would say over time, God has the ability, as even if you, as you think about it through, you know, CR and a step program, that I'm able to kind of unpack that, you know, trauma, if you will, you know, piece by piece in such a way that God's able to heal that, you know, as I'm able to recognize I am better able to feel that now incrementally according to his timing.
Yeah.
Not according to mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does.
And the other part where I was coming back to, you know, as you were talking about it, you know, being habitual, I want to recognize, you know, there's a lot of, well, communication, as we think about it, you know, in its whole sense, you know, the primary or the major parts of communication have more to do with body language and tone than the actual words we use. The actual words we use are about 7%. Actual body language is about 55%, and tone is like 38% of the communication we have.
And yet, so much of our communication is text messages, emails.
Well, that's why we miss out.
Yeah.
That's why we get so confused. It's like, you know, especially, and here again, I'm not being critical, but especially when we're not able to use, when we don't use our punctuation, even in our text, because we can't understand where the divider comes into play, you know, where that sentence stopped or, you know, those kind of things. It's like, what do we do with that? Mm-hmm. But, you know, being able to recognize that so much of our communication happens to where when I see, okay, a tone, when I see body language, okay, when I hear a tone, okay, so much of that can be connected to when I've heard that tone before, all from my primary function in the back of my head. It's like, okay, I've heard that tone before. I know what that means. Okay. And yet you may not, you know, that's where the words tend to matter. Yeah. But as I'm thinking about this, and a lot of this comes out of family systems, you know, that process, being able to recognize that the average emotion lasts approximately, let's see, 90 to 120 seconds. Hmm. The average emotion, granted, sadness, grief can last for days. But when I stop and think about that in the process of the average emotion happens in basically 1.5 to 2 minutes. Okay. I'm going to recognize that so often I tend to feel that emotion in the first 20 seconds, you know, in that process, it's starting. But then as it gets towards 80 seconds, I feel that ramping up of the emotion. And so often what happens is, like many things, I get to that, instead of allowing that 90 and 120 seconds to go by and experiencing a normal de-escalation.
Like the bell curve.
And the bell curve, yes. And say, being able to say, oh, okay, that's what sadness felt like. Yeah, that's it's okay for me to be sad, and I can go to the other side. And sure enough, there's another emotion that came. And it's okay. But if I get to that, and this is where we've found in family systems, if I get to that 80 or a little less than that, and somebody does something because we can't tolerate that emotion, that's where we create that biofeedback loop. That's where I believe alcohol can come into play, and it becomes a short circuit to my ability to experience that emotion and have a natural release that comes with, like, with a bell-shaped curve. You follow me? So we and then once we get that biofeedback loop, okay, we're able to recognize the tendency is, well, I can't stand that.
Right.
You know, that right. That becomes the thing that we say, I can't and deal it's
not
with this.
The struggle, too, isn't even that it's not just your brain saying that. I mean, the fact that it's a biofeedback loop is your body telling your brain that, and your brain agreeing and kind of this.
Sure. And it's emotional.
Yeah.
Because it's being emotionally led, not necessarily wise mind, cognitively led.
Yeah, but when addiction's at its worst, mm-hmm. someone will tell you, my emotions say I don't want to do this again. My brain tells me that I don't mm-hmm. want to do this again, and yet I have to.
Sure.
Right? So that's what I'm saying. Like, I think it gets to the point where emotions are kicked aside, your brain's kicked aside, and that biofeedback loop is ruling, right? Sure. Like it's saying, you need this now, get it now, get it now, get it now. It's like freaking out at you.
And
you,
exactly.
I have to obey, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah.
To not have this would be terrible, awful.
Right.
Yeah. And that's where that emotional dynamic comes into play from my, and that loop just gets quicker and quicker because like a muscle group, if you will, it's becoming a weaker.
Atrophied. Yeah.
Yeah. It's atrophied at that point. So then that ability to be able to say, okay, no. And then, you know, you'll talk about this, we talk about it from the aspect of 5 minutes can be an eternity. You know, that aspect, but being able to recognize, okay, if I can endure something for a certain length of time, I'm better able to recognize I can lengthen that length of time. Mm-hmm. And in that process, and I think that's where that focus, if you will, that meditation, because as I'm able to choose my focus and avoid going down the rabbit trail, I'm able to deal with a multitude of emotions better, whether it's anxiety. And this is, you know, quite often in where I'm coming from, you know, we'll call it, you know, the rabbit trail, or, you know, going down the rabbit hole or something like that. And I recognize how so often the average individual doesn't even recognize that they are going there. You follow me? Because it has been such a default to be able to avoid pain, to be able to avoid a circumstance, that it's become that habit to where that's just where I go. So when someone wrestles with that anxiety, it makes perfect sense that I've just gone down to, if you will, that what if rabbit hole. Well, what if that happens? Well, then, if that happens, then what if this happens? And, you know, and it's that process. I just heard myself say, you know, and I'm not supposed to say that so often, but I'm being mindful.
But I didn't know, so that was helpful. No, I know I don't know. Keep going.
But in that process, that's when I'm living in that default mechanism. I'm in my what part of the brain?
Limbic.
Nice.
What was the other word? The S word.
It's a C, actually.
C.
It's actually single. Yeah, I have a tough time saying it. Cingulate.
Cingulate.
C-I-N-G-U-A-L. Cingulate.
Cingulate.
Yeah.
No one's going to argue with you except Lizzie.
Well, yeah. I'll get a text after this one just for clarification, and I'll put the corrections in as they come forward. But
cingulate.
Cortex. Yes. That's where our emotions, that's where our, and that's actually, that is actually in the prefrontal cortex, which is in the towards the front of our brain.
Yeah.
But that being said, that's where the whole aspect of meditation comes into play, is my ability to exercise what I focus on, to be able to catch myself when I'm shifting away and be able to bring that back in such a way that I practice doing it. And think about it. I mean, it's, for me, I can think about multiple people who I routinely hear, you know, talk about the anxiety, you know, that they're experiencing. And I'm, you know, and that's not to say that those people aren't experiencing it less, because we tend to, you know, work on that kind of thing. But it makes sense that so often in our desire to create control, or our desire, we do it our way. But I believe, you know, God has given us this ability to be able to kind of remain focused in such a way that says, as a person thinks, you know, so they become. And I think that's an important part of that.
Yeah. And I mean, and you see that with anxiety, right? As they think, so they become. As they think about all the circumstances, they become anxious, right?
Sure.
I like to peel apart a little bit.
Go ahead.
I think they're both equally valuable, but I feel like they're slightly different applications. So mindfulness and meditation.
Sure.
I mean, maybe they're synonyms in some ways, right?
I hear.
I feel like meditation is the practice of mindfulness.
Yep.
In other words, I'm taking an opportunity right now to be mindful when I don't have to be. Right?
Sure.
So that's kind of
choosing.
So that's kind of my perception of meditation, is like, I'm going to set aside some time to practice mindfulness, right?
Yep.
Where mindfulness in action to me looks more like in the moment, seeing the emotions on the bell curve and thinking about those emotions, processing them as they're floating in front of me.
Yep, I
give
you that.
As I'm angry and I'm furious, I'm kind of able to think about that thought.
Yes.
Mindfulness is the ability
process
to watch
it.
The emotions like a train in front of you.
Yep.
Right? Your own emotions, being able to see them come through and say, yeah, I'm mad right now. Oh, I'm a little less mad. Oh, I must be getting past the bell curve. I'm a little less mad or whatever. Oh, now I'm sad. I'm not mad anymore. And being able to, you know, like we have that unique ability as God's creation above and over and above animals, right? To actually be able to think about our thoughts, which is an incredible gift that I think sometimes we take for granted.
Mm.
And we kind of slip into more of that animal type. Don't think about our thoughts, just experience the thought.
Sure.
You know? I don't know. So what are your thoughts about peeling those things apart? Where mindfulness is maybe more the...
I wouldn't... mindfulness, I believe, is like you're saying, it's kind of that process of being aware. And I think, you know, meditation is the exercise that I practice every morning so that I can be a little more, I can have a little more strength to practice mindfulness throughout my day.
Yeah.
Is that basically what I thought I heard you say?
I think so.
Yeah.
And I only say that because I don't think they're always used interchangeably.
I agree.
They're used specifically for specific purposes. And I think, especially when you think of meditation, you don't think, oh, somebody's, you know, verbally abusing me right now. You know, go into my meditation state.
Sure.
That's not typically, you know, a thing.
No,
right?
I hear you.
So meditation is typically more of a solitary, intentional, momentary, you know, regular, periodic type of thing, where mindfulness is more in the moment.
Yeah. But so if we're able to say that meditation is that moment where I focus on who God says I am, and then I go out into the world and somebody else starts to redefine who I am, I'm able through mindfulness to be aware of what I've just heard or practiced previously.
Right.
And I'm able to say, that may be the way that you see me, but that's not necessarily who I am.
Yeah.
Whereas before, without that practice,
right,
I would have said, oh, shucks, that's exactly who I am, and you get to define me.
Yeah. The thing that's amazing about this idea is how powerful it really is and how much value I would say pop culture doesn't give it, right? It's like, you need Xanax. Well, what if I told you for 5 minutes a day, you could do this practice and you won't need Xanax.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
Maybe no, and here again, we're not giving medical advice at this point. Right. You know, that kind of disclaimer in the whole process. Yes. But I'm in agreement with you.
But because we certainly shouldn't be getting our medical advice from pop culture either. So
exactly.
But yes.
But being able to recognize, kind of as I shared at the beginning, you know, more and more physicians, if you will, are basically recommending, you know, meditation as a treatment for, you know, blood pressure issues, anxiety, you know, depression, those kind of things because of that, what I would consider that default brain setting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's
cingulate cortex, limbic system.
There you go. But yes. But yes, that's where that comes from. And it's interesting, you know, as we look towards the monks, if you will, you know, on average, these guys are, you know, 15 to 50, you know, the average some cases on some of the studies is like 35 years. These individuals have been practicing this, you know, technique.
Yeah.
And so therefore, you know, you recognize that it's not necessarily something that's just you can do, but yet you can't just do it at the snap of a finger. But yet if you give it a shot for 2 weeks, you're going to you are going to experience some benefit of that behavior in some way.
Yeah. And if you, there's some cool reading about that monk stuff, and like, you can hear about some of the things that they can do as a result of that. And it sounds almost supernatural and very similar to when you watch the Olympics and you see some of the people doing the best of the best of the best in terms of any given sport. You're just like, that looked like magic. That doesn't look like no human being should be able to do that.
Exactly.
Right?
I hear you.
And yet that human being just did. And the one right before him did it almost as good. And the one right before it did almost, you know, it's like, so there's multiple individuals all in a competition to do a thing that doesn't look like a human should ever be able to do. And I think that should be encouraging in the sense that I guarantee you any monk you talk to would say, you also can do this.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I can teach you.
Yep.
It's not difficult. Yep. You know, the stuff I do is difficult, but, you know, I practiced, right?
Sure.
Same with the Olympic skier. Like, maybe you won't ever be an Olympic, you know, winner or whatever, but I can teach you to ski. You can be good at it, and you can enjoy it, and it can be something that brings value to your life. Well, this is more than just fun. This is talking about, like, controlling, that's a strong word, controlling your brain, right? Mm-hmm. Like, being able to have strength over your brain's impulses and defaults.
Yep.
And every single person has the opportunity to do that. And in fact, a lot of times you'll find, you know, you hear stories about people who go to prison or what, or solitary confinement, and they're forced into this kind of left alone with their brain, and something happens there, and they start to learn, oh, you know, me and my brain are left here alone, and I can control it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I think it's really cool. You hear stories of stuff like that. And I think of Viktor Frankl, you know, pretty good. Mm-hmm. Famous psychiatrist talking about being in Nazi prison camps and realizing, like, oh, like they can try and force me to hate myself mm-hmm. and all whatever, but I actually just don't have to. You know, they can exactly. try and take my freedom of my thoughts, but they can't. They can't sure. reach into my brain and take my freedom of thoughts. When they want me to be angry, I can say, I choose not to be. You know,
sure.
Just he had some really cool you know,
and I think,
thoughts about that.
And I think so often, this is, you know, the whole, there's a behavioral triangle, if you will, that's basically at the bottom, if I may, you would have on my right, you would say have thoughts. And on my left, on the bottom, you would have feelings. And at the top, you would have behavior. Okay. So your Viktor Frankls are basically taking that thought, and they can feel, but they're not letting, so they'll think, feel, develop a behavior. Whereas if we're going into, and then that behavior corrects, helps them recognize the benefit of the thought. You follow me? Does that make sense? As we look at a triangle and go around it. So if I'm thinking, then feeling, that'll be decided behavior. I'll get a completely different behavior if I'm going the other direction from my left to my right. Mm. If I'm allowing my feeling to decide what I think, then I get a completely different behavior at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
For example, I see you downtown. I come out of a store downtown. I wave to you. Okay. You don't wave back. Now, at that point,
sorry.
Yeah, but I never heard you say sorry. I have the ability to take that feeling, okay, of rejection and tend to say my behavior, I'm not going to wave at Justin again. You follow me in that mm-hmm. process? Or I can allow my thoughts to say, okay, I felt rejection. I can go to my thought and say, that's not like Justin. He must be thinking about a lot. He must be busy. So then and my behavior doesn't change. I'll still wave to you the next time. But if I allow that rejection to decide what my thought is versus my thoughts deciding what that feeling was, it makes a tremendous difference on my behavior over time. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
And I, as you were talking about the Olympic people, and by all means, I think about those people who definitely, you know, memorize scripture. Well, there's an individual from CR. There's one individual who has an Olympic ability to memorize scripture. And like I say, she came to mind in that process of being able to say, yeah, that's Olympic type.
Mm-hmm.
You know, biblical memorization of scripture. Mm-hmm. And I'm always impressed by that, you know.
Yeah.
It's like I got my Bible right in front of me and, you know, and I'm stumbling to find the font, get it so I can see it in my glasses. And it's almost like she's already telling me the scripture as you read it out. So that's always, you know, an impressive thing. And I can't imagine how that would transform a person's, you know, perspective on who they are, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense?
It does make sense. And just so we're clear, the Bible talks about this a lot.
Yes, very much so.
It talks about meditating on his word day and night.
Yes.
Tie it around your know, neck. Take it with you.
Yep. Teach it to your children.
Teach it to your children. Yeah. Like there's so many scriptures about just staying focused on him. And it's because he knows all of the science. He designed the science, you know?
Exactly.
And I always, like we've talked about this before, I always love when science kind of catches up to what the Bible's saying. And the Bible has been saying this since the beginning of time.
Sure.
And we just chalk it up to one of God's rules.
Yeah.
And then science goes, no. God knew the science. And, you know, and we go, oh, yeah, because he made the science, right?
Sure.
So I think that's really cool. The Bible. So when you read the Bible, as you should be, you know, meditate on day and night, right?
Sure. I have his word in my heart.
Bring it in. Yeah. Hide God's word in your heart. Yep.
Yeah.
As you're doing those things, like as you read the scriptures, pay attention to where he's talking about this stuff and see how significant it really is in his word. How valuable, how important it is. And this is why,
yeah,
because it will, like the Bible says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is how he does it. His words.
Sure.
His words will transform your mind. Well, no doubt. He gives a whole book of them. So that's why he says meditate on them, because those words will transform your mind, because those words are truth, and the ones that are fighting around in your cingulate cortex typically aren't truth, right?
Very much
full
so.
Truth.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Justin.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Any other concerns, questions? And I appreciate I just wanted you to know, I appreciate the clarification between, you know, meditation and mindfulness. And granted, like you say, I probably initially used them interchangeably, but I agree with you in that process. They're not, you know, necessarily completely synonymous.
But equally important.
Oh, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're complementary, I think.
Exactly. It's a good clarification. Of they're not the same word.
Yeah.
And, you know, one is the exercise of the other in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go do that. Turn us off and do some meditation.
Meditate for a moment after you shut off the podcast.
Also, that's why music's good. Like, music's a good thing for some people. For some people, it enhances focus on the thing that they want to be meditating on.
Sure.
For some people, they it's not. It's distracting. And
it can bring the pain, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
So,
music has
put
that.
Put some music on.
You're going to have to. Well, that'll be another good subject.
It would, yeah.
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 That'd be one for you to lead. Since we got
Elias Dumber?
No. All I can think of is octave. Since we got octave figured out there, that's the eighth note, so this next level up.
That's
but
right.
Same note.
The next level.
Yeah.
Eight up.
So now we got that
eight
figured
steps
out.
Up
we could,
on your
we could
the
talk
same
about
step just higher.
That's right. Now that we got that figured out, we could talk about music as
meditation.
The how we see music being beneficial or not. So
yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing, Justin.
Yeah. No, thank you, Mark. Thanks for bringing the cingulate cortex limbic words.
System. That's how we see it.
Hey, thank you for listening to our podcast. If you like How I See It, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us, and or talk nicely about us on social media. If you want to reach out, the email is us@howiseeit.click. Yep, I said .click, as in .click. Please tell your friends about this show, and we'll see you on the next one.